In a world where parenting advice often feels contradictory and overwhelming, Bless This Mess offers a refreshing middle path that combines sound psychological science with progressive Christianity. This book has become a quiet phenomenon among parents seeking to raise spiritually grounded children without rigid fundamentalism. Michelle Obama reportedly keeps a copy on her nightstand, while celebrities like Kristen Bell have praised its balanced approach to discipline and spirituality. What makes this collaboration between Pastor Molly Baskett and child psychologist Ellen O'Donnell so powerful is their willingness to embrace the beautiful chaos of family life rather than promising unrealistic perfection. As the book has spread through parenting circles, it's sparked a movement of parents reclaiming spiritual practices while rejecting the shame-based approaches of previous generations. At the heart of this revolutionary parenting approach lies what the authors call the Holy Trinity of Parenting, a framework combining autonomy support, structure, and involvement. Rather than viewing children as raw material to shape or fundamentally flawed beings requiring correction, Baskett and O'Donnell encourage parents to discover who their children truly are and love them further into being. This approach draws from the biblical wisdom found in Proverbs 22:6, "Train children in the right way, and when grown, they will not stray." The authors explain that "in the right way," in the original Hebrew, means according to the child's own nature and temperament, working with their grain rather than against it. Children are fearfully and wonderfully made, with distinct personalities that may differ dramatically even from siblings. The framework is supported by self-determination theory, which reveals that humans need three key elements for intrinsic motivation: autonomy, feeling in control of their own choices; competence, feeling effective in their environment; and relatedness, experiencing warmth and secure attachment. When these needs are met, children become psychologically healthier, curious explorers who internalize values rather than merely obeying rules. Finding the balance between these elements is crucial. Autonomy without structure creates boundaryless relationships, involvement without autonomy creates helicopter parenting, and structure without involvement risks tyranny. The authors reassure parents that good enough parenting means constantly adjusting these elements, while remembering that a higher parent is always present for both them and their children. This balanced approach rejects both authoritarian parenting, which undermines intrinsic motivation, and permissive parenting, which fails to provide necessary guidance. Instead, it emphasizes that having authority differs from being controlling. Setting clear limits is actually a form of love, providing children with necessary structure while still respecting their autonomy. Most children's entertainment presents clear heroes and villains, but real-life morality is far messier. While anti-bullying programs categorize kids as bullies, bystanders, or upstanders, these labels don't prepare children for complex moral dilemmas where the right choice isn't obvious. Progressive theology offers Jesus as a model of complex moral reasoning, someone who answered questions with questions, trusting people's internal moral compass. Psychologists like Piaget and Kohlberg observed that children progress from black and white moral thinking based on fear of punishment to more complex reasoning considering others' perspectives. Young children follow rules to avoid punishment, while teens might avoid shoplifting both to prevent parental disappointment and because they understand it harms store owners. At the highest level, adults wrestle with moral complexity, like whether stealing medication for a sick child is truly wrong in an unjust system. While children develop moral reasoning gradually, they can handle more complexity than we assume. Through scaffolding, parents can use hypothetical scenarios, biblical stories, and real-world moral conflicts to elevate their children's moral reasoning beyond simple black-and-white thinking. Vygotsky's concept of the zone of proximal development suggests children learn best when challenged just beyond their current abilities with adult guidance. Even toddlers absorb the myth of redemptive violence, the cultural narrative that divides conflicts into good versus evil, justifying violence when used by the good guys. This myth satisfies our need to locate evil outside ourselves and creates a false sense of safety. Instead of reinforcing this narrative, parents can introduce theological understanding of God's goodness, human free will, and sin as separation from God, self, and others. The Bible brims with antiheroes, bad parents, rebellious teens, liars, and thieves who demonstrate that humans can change. These stories remind us that transformation often comes through suffering and maturation. One-strike policies in schools and homes contradict this developmental truth by leaving no room for repentance or reconciliation. When children inevitably make poor choices, parents must stay calm and distinguish between disappointment in their choice versus disappointment in them as people. This crucial distinction helps children internalize values while understanding that bad decisions don't make bad people. Child development research shows that to raise truly moral humans, children need opportunities to think, reason, and sometimes make mistakes. Family conflict is inevitable, but how we handle it shapes our children's development. The fifth commandment, to honor our father and mother, provides a foundation for understanding parent-child conflict. Parenting expert Wendy Mogul notes that if you don't teach your children to honor you, you'll have a very hard time teaching them anything else, adding that God made this a commandment precisely because children aren't naturally inclined to respect parents. Evolutionarily, parent-child conflict stems from the need for independence. Children must learn to venture away from parents to develop survival skills, while parents instinctively want to protect them. Jesus himself modeled this tension, abandoning his father's profession, leaving his mother to his siblings' care, and even as a 12-year-old, disappearing during a family trip to the temple. To foster respect and manage conflict effectively, parents must first identify their core values, their hills worth dying on, and engage the entire family in creating a mission statement that everyone agrees to follow. This shared set of principles provides a reference point for decision-making and can reduce conflict when choices align with or contradict these shared values. When conflicts arise, Jesus' third way rejects both passive submission and domination, instead asserting the core human needs of both parties. Rather than coming at our children, which triggers fight, flight, or humiliated surrender, we can come alongside them. This means physically sitting next to rather than across from them, getting to their level, and making clear we're not there to overpower them. During a child's meltdown, the parent's goal should be maintaining self-control even when the child cannot. The approach should mirror what mental health professionals do in crisis, provide choices with clear structure, explaining consequences, while maintaining caring involvement, staying present, hearing them out. Nonviolent communication offers a framework for de-escalating conflicts. Observe your feelings, observe the other person's feelings, identify needs based on those feelings, and make requests. Taking deep breaths when emotionally flooded helps tremendously. The 4-5-8 breath, inhale for 4 counts, hold for 5, exhale for 8, works for both adults and children when tensions rise. Jesus told his disciples to forgive not just 7 times, but 77 or even 490 times. Many parents have already surpassed this number with their children. Much of our anger stems from fear that our children won't turn out okay. By letting love overwhelm fear, we can forgive both our children and ourselves, giving everyone second and 490th chances. This sensitive subject of money and materialism challenges readers to examine their relationship with wealth and possessions. By global standards, most American families are extraordinarily wealthy, regardless of how they perceive themselves. The central questions are, what is your family history with money? What do you want your family story to be? And what do you want to communicate to your kids about how much is enough? Christianity's countercultural stance on wealth consistently prioritizes challenging materialism and ending poverty. Jesus's warnings about storing up treasures on earth are contrasted with practical modern concerns like retirement savings. Christians are called to give until it hurts and then continue until giving feels good again. Research confirms the paradox of generosity. Generous people are happier, healthier, and more grateful despite our biological instincts to hoard resources. Teaching children to distinguish between needs and wants from an early age is essential, using precise language that acknowledges real suffering in the world. Our spending patterns create either abundance or scarcity mindsets in our children as they observe our financial choices and often develop the gimmies when they see parents spending on wants. For practical financial education, dividing allowance into thirds, savings, charitable giving, and spending helps children develop financial literacy. While research shows chores benefit children's development, the authors don't link allowances to chores, believing children should contribute to family work without payment. Instead, they recommend keeping weekly spending money low while offering opportunities to earn extra through additional work. Many parents avoid discussing money, creating taboos that communicate scarcity. Transparent, non-anxious conversations about finances help children develop healthier relationships with money. Society's equation of wealth with personal worth is challenged, noting that both love of money and shame about it can be destructive. Research confirms Jesus's teaching that generosity brings happiness. Studies show well-being increases with income up to about $70,000, then plateaus and eventually flatlines around $200,000. Despite most parents working out of necessity, children consistently report wanting quality time with their parents more than material things. What kids truly desire is for their parents to be less stressed, more present, and fully focused during family time. Finding meaningful moments of connection requires deliberately downshifting from the relentless pace of everyday life, sometimes requiring parents to work less, spend less, and disappoint people outside the family. Jesus's way is fundamentally about serving others, especially those different from us. The Good Samaritan parable illustrates this principle. We're called to show mercy to everyone, even strangers and enemies. The challenge for busy parents is finding ways to instill this service ethic when life already feels overwhelming. Most parents say they want their children to be kind, but children often believe their parents prioritize happiness above all. This disconnect happens because modern parents focus extensively on children's feelings rather than balancing this with teaching responsibility toward others. Richard Weisbord of Harvard's Making Caring Common project suggests we should ask children not only how they feel, but how their actions affect others. Service doesn't require grand gestures. It can be integrated into daily life through small acts like acknowledging homeless people, volunteering at food banks, or helping elderly neighbors. Children observe how we treat everyone, from telemarketers to cashiers, learning from our example. Creating a family mission statement by discussing core values helps establish service as a family identity. We are the kind of family who looks out for the underdog. While tolerance was once our cultural buzzword, it falls short of what people truly need: wholehearted acceptance and love. God made everyone good, and we must teach our children to embrace differences rather than merely tolerate them. The best way to help children navigate diversity is making their current world more diverse. If we're white, do we have friends of different skin tones? Do we unconsciously consider white culture superior? Difference isn't scary when children regularly meet the people underneath the differences and discover their common humanity. Progressive Christianity calls this the Kingdom of God, where God's people gather in dignity, peace, and mutual respect on a horizontal axis rather than a hierarchical kingdom. For white, educated, middle-class people, service projects risk reinforcing privilege by positioning others as poor ones we're helping through our generosity. Yet overthinking can paralyze us from serving at all. The key is approaching service with humility and awareness, focusing on building relationships rather than fixing others. Modern Sundays rarely resemble the restful Sabbath Christians long for. Instead of relaxed family meals and enjoyable activities, many families experience exhaustion, unfinished homework, and household chaos. Building rhythms of rest, play, and spiritual observance into family life can improve not just Sundays, but every day. Research confirms that the best way to raise spiritually minded children is to attend to your own spiritual practices. This means more than just church attendance. It requires integrating spirituality into daily life. Many parents have left religious institutions that felt controlling or limiting, but in doing so, abandon the structure church provides for raising children with faith. Parents are their children's first and best ministers, what Martin Luther called the priesthood of all believers, even with our doubts, which Frederick Buchner called the ants in the pants of faith. God speaks through ancient Bible stories, but also through everyday encounters. Share your own mystical experiences with your children. Tell them how you pray, not how they should pray, and take their spiritual questions seriously. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel wrote that entering Sabbath's holiness requires laying down the profanity of clattering commerce. Shabbat literally means stop. Jewish Sabbath observances are beautifully simple. Stop working, especially mothers, light candles, bless bread and wine, share a meal. Sabbath isn't a guilty pleasure, but a divine gift and commandment, the longest of the Ten Commandments, as if God anticipated our protests about slowing down. Dr. Stuart Brown's research revealed a disturbing pattern. 90% of murderers with no prior criminal history had their play severely restricted as children. Further studies showed play develops empathy, reduces stress, fosters innovation, and helps us adapt to change. Play is any activity that's purposeless, dissolves ego boundaries, and brings joy, something that delights God, who is the first to play through creation. Prayer extends far beyond asking God for things, as children intuitively understand. Anne Lamott's simple prayer framework offers an accessible approach for families. Help me prayers normalize asking God for assistance. Thank you prayers cultivate gratitude. And wow prayers acknowledge moments of awe and wonder, making God a present partner in daily life. Research shows regular family meals provide significant benefits: reduced teenage anxiety and risky behaviors, less disordered eating, higher GPAs, and improved self-esteem. Device-free meals create space for meaningful storytelling and ethical discussions. Saying grace before meals helps transform ordinary eating into spiritual practice. It reduces snappishness, centers attention on God, cultivates gratitude, and slows down eating. Christianity offers a fundamentally body-positive theology centered on God's incarnation as a fully human being in Jesus. Between Christmas, God taking human form, and Easter, God not abandoning bodies in death, Jesus demonstrated joyful embodiment through celebrations, shared meals, and physical affection. Unfortunately, conventional Christian teaching often became body negative, adopting just say no attitudes toward physical pleasure. The problem with binary moral thinking is that reality is more nuanced. Research shows that abstinence-only education and just-say-no approaches to drugs don't work. Teens with limited information are actually at higher risk. Instead, effective education provides options: abstinence, delay, moderation, accurate information about peer behaviors, and skills to make autonomous choices. For many parents, discussing sex is more challenging than discussing God. Many carry complicated sexual histories that may include trauma, regret, or confusion. Before guiding children, parents might need to heal their own relationship with sexuality, remembering that God offers second chances and forgiveness. A progressive Christian definition of healthy sexuality might be: good sex is sex that is good for everybody involved. Paul's teaching that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit suggests our bodies are uniquely ours, but not entirely our own. Progressive Christianity acknowledges diverse sexual histories while affirming everyone's preciousness to God. When talking with children about sex, parents should call body parts by their proper names, which shows openness to discussing potentially embarrassing topics respectfully. Teaching consent is equally crucial. Children should understand their bodies belong to them alone, and they have permission to say no when feeling uncomfortable, regardless of who is making them feel that way. Body image begins with parents modeling healthy attitudes. Research shows mothers particularly influence daughters' body image through how they talk about their own bodies, not their children's. Parents should avoid negative self-talk about weight or appearance, never discuss dieting, and instead focus on healthy eating and exercise for feeling good. The core message: children need to hear their bodies are beautiful gifts, fearfully and wonderfully made. Rather than simply saying just say no about substances, parents should have nuanced conversations, discussing real consequences of different substances, and ensuring children know they can always call for a ride without judgment. The goal isn't prohibition, but teaching discernment, helping children understand how substances affect themselves and others.
Jesus urged his followers not to worry about life's necessities, but he wasn't clear on the how-tos. As parents, worry comes naturally. Having children means forever having your heart walking around outside your body. The hard truth is that following every parenting suggestion won't immunize your child against tragedy. But brave parenting isn't about never worrying. It's about finding enough room around the fear that worry doesn't dictate your decisions. There's a crucial difference between worry and prayer. Worry keeps anxieties trapped in our heads until they grow monstrous. Prayer surrenders our concerns to someone with a broader perspective. Worry says, "I am master of my universe, but lack the power to ensure the outcome I want," making worry a failed tyrant replacing God. Prayer acknowledges, "I am not in charge," and surrenders to the outcome, trusting that despite our worst imaginings, things may turn out better than expected. Jesus advises us to focus on today's troubles rather than tomorrow's potential worries. This practical wisdom aligns with modern psychology. Catastrophizing about future possibilities creates unnecessary anxiety. The key is distinguishing between what's possible versus probable. Two essential practices for worrying well: never worry alone, share concerns with trusted friends, teachers, or professionals, and seek help when struggles appear in multiple areas of life, the rule of twos and threes. The most important message parents need to communicate to children with differences or challenges is that they are not broken, bad, or a burden, but beautiful and made in God's image. While God didn't cause their condition, God can use these challenges to bring awareness, gifts, and goodness into their lives and the lives of others. Anxiety disorders affect about 1/4 of teenagers, with 1 in 20 experiencing severe anxiety. The authors offer 5 key principles for helping anxious children. 1. Don't let them avoid fears completely, but take gradual steps. 2. Don't hide scary information from children, as they're emotionally attuned and will sense something's wrong. 3. Take children's worries seriously while recognizing their unique perspective. 4. Consider how age, development stage, and temperament shape their reactions. And 5. Understand that managing worry is an ongoing process requiring multiple conversations. Before ending, there's one more reason to cut back on worry. Your anxiety can negatively impact your children through overprotection, while depression can lead to distant parenting. Both conditions are highly heritable, 40 to 50%, though environment matters equally. This is your mandate for self-care, putting your own oxygen mask on first to avoid passing anxiety to your children. This book took longer than anticipated to write, as patients, parishioners, and children kept providing new material, each story revealing another layer of truth about parenting's complex journey. There's no neat ending, because we're still in the messy middle of our children's and our own unfolding stories. Some children are launching into adulthood, others navigating adolescence, while we parents continue growing alongside them. As Madeline L'Engle wisely observed, we are every age we've ever been and all we might become. Only God knows the complete picture, seeing the beginning from the end. Our primary parenting task is knowing and loving our children as God does, with all their beauty, flaws, and imperfections. This means celebrating their quirks, understanding their struggles, and accepting their unique paths. We won't always like our children or feel in love with them, especially during challenging phases like the terrible twos or teenage rebellion. But parenting is love school, training us to fall into the love that is greatest. It teaches us to love beyond behavior, beyond achievement, beyond our expectations. When we love our children as they are, not our idea of them, we train them in the way they should go, allowing their authentic selves to emerge. God exists in the space between people, in the midnight conversations with a troubled teen, in the silent car rides after difficult days, in the small moments of connection over shared laughter or tears. Nothing can separate us from this love, not their latest craze that makes us cringe, not their oppositional behavior that tests our patience, not their anxiety that keeps us up at night, not their depression that breaks our hearts, or even death itself. If you love this way, your children will teach you to have faith in them and perhaps a greater faith in the one who made them as he witnessed their resilience, growth, and capacity for change. The ultimate message of Bless This Mess isn't that perfect parenting creates perfect children. Such perfection doesn't exist, and pursuing it only leads to frustration and disappointment. Instead, embracing imperfection with grace creates space for authentic growth and connection. It allows for mistakes, learning, and genuine relationships to develop. In the beautiful mess of family life, the cluttered rooms, the interrupted conversations, the imperfect holidays, the daily chaos, God isn't waiting for us to get everything right. Rather, God is present in the chaos, blessing our imperfect efforts with unexpected moments of transcendence and joy, turning our messiness into opportunities for growth, connection, and deep, abiding love.